Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Okay, this is episode 278. We've got a great episode this week. I'm actually reaching back into the archives and grabbing an article from the Working Tools magazine from back in 2014. Before we get started this week, I just wanted to mention in the news that, of course, there was last week at the end of the episode kind of a little bonus if you figured it out. Cool. If you didn't, I'll give it away. There was a website, and it says thedcgathering.com. You can go there and check it out. There's a little bit of a puzzle going on there. If you know why, cool. If not, no big deal. Just wait, and the details will come at some point, I'm sure. Outside of that, I do want to go ahead and mention, because we are just a few weeks away, University Masonic Lodge number 1190 AFNAM in Austin, Texas, is having their 8th annual festive board where they've invited me to be the keynote speaker. I'm going to be speaking about the word, myth, legend, and science. It's going to be really cool. It'll be Thursday, January 26th, 2017, social hour and silent auction at 6. Dinner will be served at 7. Again, that's going to be at the Austin Club at 110 East 9th Street. The proceeds benefit Austin Children's Shelter, UT Elementary School, Anthropos Arts, and other local children's charities through the University Masonic Charitable Foundation. If you have questions, you can email them to foundation@uml1190.org, or you can just go to universitylodge.org and click on the links to go right to the event page. Brief synopsis of the presentation I'll be giving is, throughout history, man has searched for truth, ancient religions, cults, and societies obsessed with an idea of the word, the Tetragrammaton, the true name of God, and the search has spawned numerous philosophical and theosophical ideologies. What is the true name? What is the secret? Is there a power associated with the word? In this presentation, I will try to go over and reveal everything we can about this. If you're a Master Mason, then you know the significance of the search. In addition to that, MasonicCon in April of this year, April 29th to be exact, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., Ezekiel Bates Lodge, AFNAM, is going to put on MasonicCon again, which is located at 71 North Main Street in Attleboro, Massachusetts. It's going to be a free event, open to everybody. There'll be lectures from a ton of dudes, including Greg Kaminsky, who is really awesome. I'll be there. Paul C. Smith, Pierce A. Vaughn, Angel Miller, Richard Casero, Oscar Lean. It's going to be awesome. We're also going to have an esoteric symbolism panel, which will be moderated by the one, the only Data King, John Ruark. Brother John Ruark is going to be a key choice for this. He loves that stuff. In addition, wall-to-wall vendors and the Tall Cedars and the Grotto will be there doing some degrees. So if that interests you, then perhaps this is the event to go to this year. You can find out more by going to eb1870.org. So this week I ran across a paper which was interesting because the premise for the paper actually struck a little bit of a chord with me. We all know that there are invitational, quote-unquote, higher bodies in Freemasonry. And these bodies should be pretty amazing, right? We would imagine that these bodies do some really cool degree work, might actually focus on some of the philosophical lessons within the fraternity. And this week, I was at a degree, just a Blue Lodge third degree. And one of my good friends said, "Hey, RJ, what do you know about the Knight Masons?" And I said, "Well, not a whole lot, but from what I understand, I think it's another invitational, and it's probably at a point where it's evolved just into a supper club, like a lot of the other invitational orders, including SRICF and some things of that nature, even AMD to an extent." And just at that point, a young gentleman walked past me, who was a past master, and he said, "Yeah, I'm a Rosicrucian. It's just a dinner once a year at the Union League." And I thought, wow, there it is. Apparently, a Rosicrucian is just a dinner at the Union League once a year. Now, I myself am not a Rosicrucian, but I've read enough to know that I think it probably should entail a little more than a dinner club once a year at the Union Club in Chicago. But it made me think, what happened to Freemasonry were these clubs? Now, I know I should preface this and say that I know not all Rosicrucian orders are just supper clubs. The one in Utah, for instance, I've had the privilege of talking with Brother Jason Mitchell, as well as a few other gentlemen there, and they do some fantastic work, some real work. But largely, what has happened to the fraternity in that we're not doing the work we say we're doing anymore? And I pulled out this issue, and I flipped it open to the main article, and it starts off with a quote. And I thought, this is the article for this week, because this is kind of the wine that I am wanting to taste at the moment, right? Like, it just kind of lined up. So, I hope you enjoy it. It's called Sacred Geometry in Masonry. And again, it's from the Working Tools magazine from back in 2014. Now, I kind of feel like I'm doing some guys a favor because I'm going to read this out of the magazine where the graphic interface on this particular article is not the friendliest, and there is all kinds of wild geometrical shapes behind the wording, and it's kind of a headache to read, so you're welcome. But here we go. Sacred Geometry in Masonry by Worshipful Brother M. Wolf and Brother Michael Yannetti. Quote, "It is now degenerated into a society of gluttons and wine-bibbers, who yawn while their masters expound to them those emblems which have excited the wonder of the greatest philosophers of the past, and who deem that the richest gem of Freemasonry is the banquet which closes the labor of the lodge." End quote. While some 150 years have passed since Reed recorded his despair at the state of Masonry in his book, The Veils of Isis, the departure from the original intent of the 18th century framers of the modern fraternity continues today. The days when the master of the lodge could expound on the symbolic to his brethren having long passed, and now the majority of those who have risen to height of being master often have little knowledge of the true gems hidden in plain sight. The charges contained in the ritual are treated as nothing more than interesting calls for intellectual pursuits from the past, concepts superseded now by our vast modernistic understanding of the world and universe we inhabit. There is, however, a growing movement within the fraternity of Freemasons who are actively seeking out the eternal truths, the keys to which are given to all Masons. There is nothing new in this short work, but a simple progression of part of the simple, essential truths understood by some of the greatest thinkers in their search for understanding the unknowable, so far as man ever could. It traces why Masons are implored to travel to foreign lands and seek the wisdom of the past and how it relates to the landmarks of the current gentle craft. As Masons, we are constantly reminded of the study of the seven liberal arts is a fundamental tenet of being a Mason, but more particularly, the study of geometry is imperative as it forms the foundation of the fraternity. As Masons, we are surrounded by geometrical symbolism in every facet of our environment, and its importance is frequently included in our ritual, most particularly the fellowcraft degree, as we are directed. Quote, "The study of the liberal arts, valuable branch of education, which tends so effectively to polish and adorn the mind, is earnestly recommended to your consideration, especially the science of geometry, which is established as the basis of our art. Geometry or masonry, originally synonymous terms, being of a divine and moral nature, is enriched with the most useful knowledge. While it proves the wonderful properties of nature, it demonstrates the more important truths of morality." End quote. And so, the initiate is clearly directed, but what was the basis for this direction? To uncover the origination, we need to go back in time, to the formal formation of the degrees where historically we find some confusion exists. Prior to the 1720s, only a single degree existed in any type of organized fashion. Themed as an entered apprentice degree by some and the acceptance degree by others, it could be argued that the master part was a separate degree, but the master degree we would recognize as today was only conferred after 1725, and then only to a very limited number of Masons. This single degree then was sufficient to gain entry into all lodges other than that of the perfect masters. However, Anderson and his constitutions of 1723 referred to quote-unquote having to be a fellow of the craft to take an office chair, and this could only be conferred by the Grand Lodge. As Fort Newton points out, fellow craft mastership being not a degree conferred, but a reward of skills as a workman and of merit as a man. Anderson's constitutional requirement caused problems as lodges popped up in increasing numbers. Not enough masons had risen to the exalted ranks of fellow of the craft to fill the chairs, nor could enough be so raised, as it was only the Grand Lodge that could confer such an honor. The solution appears to have been to split the acceptance degree into two, removing the geometrical portions and splitting the penal aspects eventually into three, and thereby creating the fellow craft degree. In the second degree, there appears originally to have been no distinct penalty, and when it does come in, it included some provisions that now form part of the third. But there was an addition to the ceremony in that newly made fellowcraft re-entered the lodge to receive his wages. He did so from the senior warden between the pillars after having passed a test. The earlier ritual also includes a set of verses on the letter G, with other indications that part of the working may have originally been in rhyme. The earliest account of this penalty gives it more or less as we have it currently. And so it came into being, a degree that gave the knowledge that would have been practiced by a mason who had reached sufficient proficiency to be rewarded the exalted title of Fellow of the Craft. This is special knowledge centered on an understanding of the working of sacred geometry. The earliest written material that directly connects masonry with geometry is the Halliwell manuscript, which contains the Regis poem, written circa 1390. The poem in turn refers to an earlier document, thought to be of the 10th century origin. In contrast, the document's ending section may have been slightly later edition, possibly from the mid-15th century. Most interestingly, the document uses the terms masonry interchangeably with that of geometry throughout. Here are a few lines, first in the English of the period, and then in modern English we see the interchangeability. First, on this manner through good wit of geometry, is basically saying on this manner through good wit of geometry. Line 54, began first the craft of masonry, translates to began first the craft of masonry. Line 55, the clerk Euclid on this wise height fond, translates to the clerk Euclid on this wise it found. In line 56, thys craft of geometry in Egypt lande, or land, which translates into this craft of geometry in Egypt land. Now, to break away from this paper just for a moment, these are grammatically spelled words that are spelled exactly the way they were pronounced. And this is very heavy Scottish, or very accentuated English. So it is interesting to hear that difference. Back to the paper. Not only do we see the interchangeability, but also a reference to Euclid, who authored the 13 books of Elements. Thus, the origins of the craft lay clearly with the lands of Egypt. It starts in Latin. Here begins the constitution of the art of geometry according to Euclid. Then proceeds Old English through its 794 lines. It outlines 15 articles regarding the characteristics to being a mason. Clearly, this was an important document to the framers, who made frequent references to it in both the Constitution and first published the histories. Its closing lines are perhaps better known to masons of today, where it proclaims, quote, amen, amen, so mote it be, so say we all for charity, end quote. This is the source for the response that ends all Masonic prayers. It is from the Regis poem and other early reworkings of much older material such as the Cook manuscript and numerous other documents which together are known as the Old Charges, as well as non-written traditions that gave rise to the formalized workings of the craft. While much can be said and debated by scholars and academics regarding the complexities of the influences of the formative years which preceded the resurgence of the fraternity in the early 18th century, the beacon of light and the foundation on which Masonic truths have been built has and always will remain centered around sacred geometry. What was it about sacred geometry that warranted such focus and attention? Masonry and geometry and the information associated with it carried such an import as it's said to have attracted King Athelstan's 924-939 his attention, who was Alfred the Great's grandson, and the king who claimed York back from the Vikings. He held Masonic council with the city. The writer of the Regis poem mentions Adelstein and his Masonic geometric lineage, linking it back to Euclid, and from there to the Egyptians. Although the lineage in the poem is questionable in a historical context, Masonically, its intent was deliberate. It is clear that from these earliest Masonic source documents that geometry was the liberal art that rose to the highest level of import among all of the seven liberal arts. The import was such in the ancient world that Plato, who preceded Euclid and being heavily influenced by Pythagoras, had above his 4th century BC academy door, quote, "No one who is ignorant of geometry may enter here," end quote. This was much to the chagrin of the 2nd century philosopher Justin Martyr, St. Justin, who, being refused admission to Pythagorean school due to his ignorance in these matters, then turned to the Christian path. Although geometry is thought of as the greatest of the seven liberal arts and sciences, it is listed as the fifth and not the first, as in the Cook manuscript and the Masonic ritual. While the importance placed on geometry is clear, it does not explain why it should be considered sacred. A further expert from the Prestonian lectures goes some way to explain why it should be considered sacred. Quote, "Geometry is man's physical representation of the unknowable in a form that is intelligible and constant through all conditions. Geometric progressions and laws define number theory and conditions that can be replicated on varying scales. A geometric expression drawn in the sand of a Mediterranean beach will also accurately reflect, on the grandest scale, the movement of the heavens above. Early man learned to identify by geometry the movement of the earth around the sun and gain assurance that the sun would return to bring a new growing season with it." Alluding in simple terms, the Pythagorean school dictum was quoted, quote, "All is numbers," end quote. The conclusion in thus, the nature of the nature is numbers. Therefore, the nature of God might be better understood by numbers that are revealed by geometric progressions. It was particularly to the Greeks, as noted by the Roman philosopher and statesman Cicero in his Tusculan Disputations, that, quote, "By them geometry was held in the very highest honor, and none more illustrious than the mathematicians. But we, the Romans, have limited the practice of this art to its usefulness in the measurement and calculation," end quote. In Plato's Timaeus, the universe he proposes is the product of a rational, purposive, and beneficent agency. It is the handiwork of a divine craftsman who, imitating an unchanging and internal model, imposes mathematical order on a pre-existent chaos to generate the ordered universe, or the cosmos. Bertrand Russell, when talking of Pythagoras in relation to Plato, commented, "It is to this gentleman that we owe pure mathematics. Thought became superior to the senses, intuition became superior to observation. Platonism was essentially Pythagorism. The whole concept of an eternal world revealed to the intellect but not to the senses can be attributed to Pythagoras." In his bypassing of the senses and appealing directly to the intellect, Pythagoras recognized an inbuilt intuition within man that enabled him to access the divine. In his history, The Life of Pythagoras, Lamblicus repeats the sentiment of Plato in his The Republic, that the study of the science of numbers tends to awaken that organ of the brain which the ancients described as the eye of wisdom. This is the organ now known to psychology as the pineal gland, often called the third eye, or God's gland. The ancients had a firm understanding of this role of the pineal gland and how to access it through ritual or contemplation, particularly in contemplation of numbers or geometrical progressions. Thus, the study of geometry not only revealed the workings of the divine creator in all his magnificence, but also could lead through contemplation to a state of direct communication. To Pythagoras, the monad or one, a symbol so well known by Masons as the circumpunct, was the symbolic representation of the divine. Pythagoras equated it with the number one, or as a three-dimensional extension, cone, being both male and female, odd and even, partaking of both natures, for it being added to the even makes odd, and to the odd, even. It is God because in its two-dimensional form, not only is it the beginning and end of all, but in itself has neither a beginning nor an end. Pythagoras described the indivisible unity lying behind all manifestation as no number, in this way repeating the statement in the stanzas of Dizian that, quote, "There is neither first nor last, for all is one, number issued from no number," end quote. The plane above, therefore, can be indicated only by the naught or circle, which Pythagoras said is the most appropriate symbol of divinity. On the plane below, the circle or first number appears, and from this number the geometry of the universe emerges. It is the nature of God to be the receptacle of matter, because it produces the essential material duad. In the phenomenal world, the monad or monad becomes the apex of the manifested equilateral triangle, or the father. The left line of the triangle becomes the duad of the mother. This represents the origin of all contrasts in nature, the point at which the roads of good and evil bifurcate, two points in space diametrically opposed, which in that state defies unity. This being the case, the Pythagoreans are said to quote-unquote hated the binary. Considering the number 2 as a representation of the law of polarity, they stress the positive aspects by not only entering a temple on the right side, and also by putting on the right shoe first. The right line of a triangle represents the sun, described in every ancient cosmogony as one with the apex or father. The line at the base of the triangle stands for the universal plane of productive nature, in which father, mother, son are all unified on the phenomenal plane, as they were united in the supersensuous world by the apex. The triangle thus becomes the most profound of all geometrical symbols. As a cosmic symbol representing the higher trinity of the universe, it becomes the root of the word deity. The ancient Greeks called the letter D, the triangular delta, the vehicle of the unknown deity. The Boeotians wrote the word Zeus with the delta, from which came the Latin deus. The triangle is also a basic form in nature. When molecules of salt deposited themselves as a solid, the first shape they assumed is that of a triangle. A flame is triangular in shape. Hence the word pyramid from the Greek pyre or fire. The triangle is also the form assumed by the pine, which is the most primitive tree after the fern. From the birth of the duad via the perfection, the perfect replication of the monad, came the world of the firmament, which was a physical mirror of the perfect. This was a philosophy not lost on Plato in his idealistic treatment. However, in its birth, it brought chaos and conflict, as noted by Manly P. Hall. Quote, the following symbolic names were given to the duad, because it has been divided, and is two rather than one, and when there are two, each is opposed to the other. Genius, evil, darkness, inequality, instability, movability, boldness, fortitude, contention, matter, dissimilarity, partition between multitude and monad, defect, shapelessness, indefiniteness, indeterminateness, harmony, tolerance, root, feed off foundation, abounding idea, top, feigns, opinion, fallacy, alterity, diffidence, impulse, death, motion, generation, mutation, division, longitude, augmentation, composition, communion, misfortunes, sustenation, imposition, marriage, soul, and science. End quote. As previously commented, the Pythagoreans revered the monad, but are said to have despised the duad because it was the symbol of polarity, and hence conflict and chaos. But from it, they also recognized the power of the duad. The deep was created in contradiction to the heavens. Quote, and God made the firmament, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so, and God called the firmament heaven. As Manly P. Hall goes on to explain, quote, the deep mirrored the heavens, and became the symbol of illusion. For below was merely a reflection of the above, and in the Platonic terms was a less perfect image. The below was called Maya, the illusion, the seed, the great void, and to symbolize it, the Magi of Persia carried mirrors. From the duad arose disputes and contentions until, by bringing the monad between the duad, equilibrium was reestablished by the Savior God, who took upon himself the form of a number and was crucified between two thieves for the sins of men. End quote. So, while the monad is a symbol of original wisdom, harmony, and divine, the duad is a symbol of ignorance and paradox, for in it exists the sense of separateness in which it is the beginning of the root of ignorance. The duad, however, is also the mother of wisdom, for ignorance out of the nature of itself invariably gives birth to wisdom. So, while the duad gave rise to the possibility of disharmony and discord, it was essential to the creation of Mother Wisdom, which is represented by the Vesia Pisces created at the intersection. The Pythagorean understood that in order to regenerate wisdom and the despised duad was essential. The Greek philosopher Heraclitus, who was a near contemporary to Pythagoras, stated, the opposite is beneficial. From things that differ comes the fairest attunement. All things are born through strife. In his book Numbers, W. Wynne Westcott says of the duad, it was called Audacity, from its being the earliest number to separate itself from the Divine One, from the A diadem of God nourished silence, as the Chaldean oracles say. As the separation occurred out of the God nourished silence, sprang the wisdom and regenerative representation of the divine on earth, the Vesia Pisces. It was from the womb of the Vesia that the ancients revealed the secrets of the divine relationship to the earthly, imperfect world. The more they developed the geometrical and mathematical relationships contained within its sacred construction, the more it reflected the relationship of the divine to the earthly realm about them. It was from this simple construct on a two-dimensional plane, which required no more than a compass and straight edge, the underlying pattern of the universe was revealed to mankind. That which was unknowable, being of divine mind, became intelligible, and gnosis of the great creator became attainable to the initiated. The importance of hermetical thought, as above so below, in bringing the two globes, terrestrial and celestial, together in the way Pythagoras did, cannot be underestimated in our modern thought systems. As demonstrated in the Flower of Life, there is evidence that the ancient Egyptians who were prior to Pythagoras knew of this type of construct. This has been identified on the ancient tomb of Seth. But either the ancient wisdom got separated from the hermetic language, or the geometrical depth possibly had eluded these earlier thinkers. How much of this Pythagoras learnt on his mystical journey, his reputed 22 years in Egypt and induction into the mysteries of the left eye of Horus, is unclear. Evidence and arguments can be made that pyramids are an expression of the knowledge and the ratios and math of the Vesia. Frank C. Higgins, in his Ancient Freemasonry, demonstrates a clear Pythagorean link to Egypt and the knowledge they had regarding what was later to be known as the Pythagorean Triangle, thus possibly showing a direct history of Pythagoras in Egypt and his potential exposure to the other deep mystical traditions, such as the relationship of Phi, or Pi. What is clear is that these progressions were a focal point of the Pythagorean school in an attempt to know better the divine, and therefore develop a universal mathematical insight to the cosmos, an insight that would later be more fully expressed by Plato in his various talks on the development of the Pythagorean three-dimensional solids. Even though Plato talked of the result of these insights in detail, as in the origination of Pi, he never revealed the origin source of production, but alluded as to how they could be found. It was not until Euclid published his Elements in 13 books on the fundamentals of geometry that the profane had their first chance to gain insights previously held within the highest mystery school adepts. It could be said that Euclid predated Brother Samuel Pritchard by some 2,300 years in his expose of 1730 on the workings of Masonic principles. From the above diagram, which is simple in construct, using no more than a compass and a straight edge, a number of mathematical expressions are found. First, the square root of 235, along with a ratio of 265 to 153, the fish. Next, the golden ratio, pi. Finally, the Pythagorean right-angled triangle theorem, along with complex geometric developments such as the seeds of life as well as the flower of life, all created from movement of the compasses created the Vesia or Vesica. In truth, the rediscovery of Pythagorean thought in the onset of the medieval period resulted in an explosion of its physical demonstration in the Gothic cathedrals, perhaps the most glorious building ever erected to God that even today cannot be rivaled. The craftsmen and clerical architects, or masters of the compass, who designed these buildings wove the pre-Christian Pythagorean understanding of the divine thought throughout the buildings, which was hidden under the nose of the established church. Such was the conviction of these masters of the import of the information they held in secret. All aspects of the design of these Gothic masterpieces, such as Chartres Cathedral, took as their source the relationship of the Vesias. This was from the observation of the flying buttresses supporting the building and the beauty of the stained glass rose windows, to the hidden of the dimensional ratios of all aspects of the layout, to the ultimate form of the building. Now, taking a further progression and looking at it with a spiritual eye, as in the above diagram, we find the unifying third monad in the center overlying those two of the outlying duad. This gives rise to a beautiful, perfect, and complete whole. This representation is thought to be the subject of mystery tradition that St. John alludes to in the telling of when Christ talked to and instructed the fishermen. This is similar to the story whereby Pythagoras is reported to have implored fishermen to try once again before they landed a large number of fish. The diagram involving the third monad brings unity to the duality and completes the whole. This is the derivation of the word Trinity. The three in tri, when brought together in unity, completes the perfect whole. It is not without reason the triangle and the number three is the world's most unified and preeminent symbol of divinity. From the Christian Trinity to the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, to the Hindus, Trimurti, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, to Buddhism's Bodhi and Nimrod's Trident, and its frequent use in Norse legends, Taoist philosophy, as expressed by Lao Tzu in 500 BCE, who was contemporary to Pythagoras but thousands of miles apart, stated that the Tao gives birth to one, the one engenders the two engenders the three, and the three engenders all things. The duality of the yin and yang gives birth to the three from which comes forth all things. The Kabbalah, the ancient Jewish mystery tradition, gives us the three pillars of the tree of life: contemplation, devotion, and action. One does not have to look far in Masonry to see the importance of the symbolism of three. It abounds in all aspects of the craft. While many saints are depicted with halos of various shapes, it is only the head of God that is seen depicted from one of a triangular form. This triangular or symbolic reference to God is not only commonly experienced in the symbology used by Masons, but one that every American is accustomed to seeing in their everyday life. This is the eye of God being contained in a triangular form at the summit of an unfinished pyramid on the $1 bill. And so, it is the number three and its symbology that represents the celestial world, now complete and whole, sprang into human contemplation out of the vesica. So too comes the square, or the fourth part of a circle. The square has long been associated with the earth or the terrestrial. Pythagoras had considered the number four to be associated with justice, wholeness, and completion, as in the saying, "I won this fair and square." Plutarch stated that Pythagoras thought the number four was of the world, because there are four seasons, four cardinal points, and it is the first number attributed as feminine representation of Mother Earth, with her four corners. The Holy Bible makes reference to the four corners in the book of Revelation 7:1. "And after these things I saw the four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor the sea, nor any tree. And I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God." Isaiah 11:12 also makes reference to the four corners of the earth, the long-held belief that the world was thought to be flat, until Magellan, in his voyage of 1519, proved otherwise, is erroneous. It was well known to the ancient Greeks of the Hellenistic period, from the work of Eratosthenes of Cyrene, 250 BCE, that the world was a sphere. He even determined its circumference accurately to within 500 miles. He was not the first. Other ancient cultures would have had an understanding of the terrestrial form, if not the magnitude, long before that date. The world was commonly referred to in terms of the four corners of Earth, and Masonically as the four winds of the heavens, scattering ash to the furthest most corners of the terrestrial, reinforcing the earthly connection to the number four. It was Plato who first described the four elemental roots that the Earth consisted of: fire, air, earth, and water, all of which were corruptible. Aristotle reasoned that the unchanging and incorruptible heavens, being divine in nature, made up a fifth element, ether. The earth, to these ancient philosophers, consisted of four root basic elements, and metaphorically, the four corners. It could be argued that the ancient Egyptians had a similar understanding of the terrestrial and celestial in the design of their pyramids. When a four-square base gave rise to the triangular sides rising to the heavens, the celestial triangle sides rising above the earthly base of the four, giving a physical representation of the Hermetic code as given by Thoth. This can also be seen in classical Greek architecture, the four squared sides of a building consisting of columns supported by the triangular covering above, where the earthly columns meet the celestial triangular roof covering the Ionic column. Capitals represent the meeting of heaven and earth. This symbolically demonstrates the energy flow rising through the temple toward the heavens. For Masons, the square is a physical symbol of the terrestrial. By it are taught to square their actions and act in the just and virtuous manner in their transactions with mankind. The compass, specifically representing the instrument by which Masons are taught to circumscribe their actions, and also alludes to the celestial triangular form. It is a teaching and symbolism that would have not been lost on Pythagoras. Pythagoras may have well understood the context of the three great lights in Masonry: the compass, the square, and the volume of sacred law. Here again, the compass is representing that which above, and the square, that which is below. Celestial, terrestrial, as above, so below, as expressed in the Hermetic Code and as Plato tells it. Quote, the beautiful order lines of the universe is not only the manifestation of intellect, it is also the model for rational souls to understand and emulate. Such understanding and emulation restores those souls to their original state of excellence, a state that was lost in their embodiment therein. There is, then, an explicit ethical and religious dimension to the discourse. End quote. Thus, the Masonic compasses represents the awakening of man's spiritual self to the celestial divine, and, in its progressing, various states of exposure showing man's conquering of the terrestrial square as the celestial triangle progressively dominates, all gilded by the divine presence. Geometry is knowledge of the eternally existent, Plato. Brother Malcolm Wolf, Masonic Bio, Master of Pulpit Rock 103, Pelham, New Hampshire, Education Officer of the Phoenix 105, Tilton, New Hampshire, District No. 2 Education Officer of the Grand Lodge of New Hampshire, Chairman of the Education Committee of the Grand Lodge of New Hampshire. He is also the York Rite Mason, as well as belonging to a number of associated bodies. Brother Michael Yannetti is an officer in two lodges, a Knight Templar, soon to be AMD, Sovereign Master, and Rosicrucian. So there you have a great article that went from some of the history into some of the symbolism and really explained the one key idea that the study of geometry reveals to the mind the divine truths of the universe. So nothing that can be written except that statement. Very interesting concept. All right, now with that, I just would like to go ahead and ask everybody to think about the show a little bit and consider picking up a pin from our limited edition shop on our website, www.wcypodcast.com. We do have the lapel pins. We still have a few cufflink sets. We have a few money clips and tie bars also. So if any of those strike your fancy, please head on over and check those out. Additionally, if you'd like to support this show, you can click on support the show on our website there. And you can go over to buybankersbest.com where you can get something really cool, which is our exclusive King Solomon's Reserve beard oil. We worked with Brother Levi to create this product and offer it through his company. And you can straight up just get it right on his website now. No more hidden links, but for a while it was super exclusive to only the listeners of this show. Additional things on his websites are some really nice beard oils and balms and lip balms and things. If you use the promo code BBWCY357, you'll get 20% off. It's really cool. In addition, please head on over to freemasonryart.com where you can save 10% by using the promo code WCY. This is fine art and Masonic art done by Juan Sepulveda, made in the USA. If that name sounds familiar, I talk about him all the time. He's, of course, one of the co-hosts of the Masonic Roundtable and one of my favorite podcasts, The Winding Stairs. He's got some really cool t-shirts right now. I'm not sure if our promo code will work on those t-shirts, but I'm really digging his 300-year shirt, which is 1717 to 2017, 300 years of the Grand Lodge. And of course, our one non-Masonic thing that we do promote is Onnit Labs, who is so generous to us here as an affiliate. If it interests you, they offer a ton of really great products from their website, onnit.com. My favorite, Alpha Brain. You can just click on the links right on our website, go through there, use the promo code WCY, you'll get 10% off. It's a great deal. With that, I just want to remind you to make sure you're checking out the Masonic Roundtable on Tuesday nights, 10, 9 Central. This Tuesday should be a really cool show. We're going to be actually talking about Doctor Strange, and we've got a really cool special guest coming up, Frater O. So we're super excited about that, and please don't forget about the Midnight Freemasons, midnightfreemasons.org, where we've got articles every week for you to check out, and we hope you enjoy. We should have Frater O on next week as well, so you can hear him on the Masonic Roundtable as well as our show here, Whence Came You. And with that, I hope you guys all have the most amazing week. So until I talk to you next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.